What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Pete Seeger would have celebrated his 95th birthday on May 3rd, this past Saturday. A five-day festival honoring the late folk singer will be taking place July 17th through July 21st in Poughkeepsie and in Manhattan Central Park. And there will also be events throughout the Hudson Valley. We thought it would be a fine topic for our show, a tribute to Pete Seeger, his nearly 70 years as a performer, a labor activist, an environmentalist, and a warrior for social justice. So this day, close to his birthday, we are going to do just that this hour of the program. We have a great guest with us, Bill Malone. Bill is the author of many, many books on American music. He was the first member of his family to attend college. He was growing up in Texas, and he became known as a local authority on hillbilly music while he was attending the University of Texas in the early 1960s. He was also an amateur performer around Austin, Texas, began sharing local stages with a number of musicians, some of whom became very famous, like Janis Joplin. He pursued his own musical scholarship of country music, which had really never been given much serious attention before. His dissertation was his first book, Country Music USA. He also has a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of American Music. He wound up in Madison, Wisconsin, and he has a radio show of country music that is widely listened to. It's a program on WORT called Back to the Country. He's Professor Emeritus of History at Tulane University and is widely acknowledged as the nation's foremost authority on Southern music. Your memories of Pete Seeger, favorite songs, his contribution to folk music and to music really bringing world music to the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Isn't it amazing, although you've been in your field for a long time too, but that Pete Seeger had a 70-year career. Holy Toledo, that's a long time.
I don't think I'll make it quite that far.
I think you
started
might.
Started a little later.
And he also, I like Joan Baez's phrase, that if it weren't for Pete Seeger, he really paved the way for so many other musicians, didn't he?
Yeah, you can refer the whole body of folk singers who came along in the late 50s, early 60s as Pete's children. In fact, that's what one writer described them, Bob Dylan, just about anybody you can name from that time period.
How does somebody who has taken on so many issues, some of which were not very popular, certainly, but his anti-war opposition, his environmentalism, his civil rights participation, which was so, so deep, how do you carry that on for all of those years and still remain a vital force?
Well, he was inherited a lot of his composure, his strength, his intellectual discipline from his father, from his forebears. Pete was lucky to be born into a very distinguished folk music family. His father was one of the first ethnomusicologists in the United States. His mother was a classical violinist, and his stepmother, Ruth Crawford Seeger, who also the mother of Mike Seeger, transcribed folk songs for the Lomax family, and there was a very close relationship between the Lomaxes and the Seegers. So I think that great longevity that Pete experienced was something he probably, got from his parents, his intellectual strength, that sense of mission. Mm-hmm. He really had that strongly. You know, he just wasn't enough just to play this music. He wanted to make sure that the entire world heard it. So he was a profoundly good man, and I think through all the various causes in which he was involved, that strength of character came out, and even his enemies could sometimes recognize that here's a good man who's from distinguished and old American stock who's doing his part to, make America strong and rid it of its, various injustices.
Mm-hmm. And he kind of turned his back a little bit on some of that preppy school Harvard education. And I guess he was he left Harvard after a couple of years because he had better things to do.
Yeah, and he'd gone to private school before that. And then 2 years at Harvard. The thing that changed his life, I guess more than any one thing, was a trip to Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, really?
That he took with his father, Charles Seeger. They went to the Asheville Folk Festival, which I think is still going on today. And he heard Bascom Lamar Lunsford, the organizer of the festival, playing the five-string banjo, as well as a woman named Samantha Baumgartner. This is the first time that Pete had ever paid any attention to that style of banjo. Before that, he'd played the tenor jazz banjo. And so he abandoned that and took up the five-string banjo and made it his weapon for the rest of his life.
And became, I read, pretty good at it in a fairly short period of time. By 4 years strumming on that thing, he was an accomplished musician.
Yeah, and that's by playing it all the time, to the great disgust of his friends. So you wake up any time in the middle of the night, and Pete was in there playing his long neck banjo. And in fact, the first banjos he had, he couldn't play F sharp on it. The story I understand is that, so he had the neck cut off and extended for three frets, which gave him the opportunity to play chords and keys that he had not played before. And so Pete was known for his long neck five-string banjo.
How important in terms of the way the songs that he wrote about and in terms of fashioning a career for himself was his meeting with Woody Guthrie?
Oh, it was indispensable. He had, as I said, he'd been hearing various folk singers at one time or another, either in Asheville or people like Aunt Molly Jackson from Kentucky, who came up to New York to plead for the miners of her home state. And then Hoodie Ledbetter, better known as Ledbetter, came along and heard his music. But I think the one event which really changed his life forever was a benefit for the migrant workers of California in the West. It was called a Grapes of Wrath benefit. Mm-hmm. And every folk singer in town came to play, and Pete played himself, and he said it was the worst night of his life. He said he couldn't play the banjo, he couldn't hit the notes, he couldn't do anything. It turned out he'd gone out on stage before he'd really become sure of himself and sure of his music. But as part of that package was this young fellow from California, Woodrow Wilson, Woody Guthrie. And Guthrie just came out, and it's just a very natural sound with no stage fright whatsoever. He just sang in his unique style, songs that he'd grown up with, and songs about the Okies and the Dust Bowl. And a little bit later, I don't know, it was that very night, but very soon thereafter, Pete met Woody at a party and made the decision to go out on the road with him. So they travel west. And this was Pete's first experience with the music of the people that he was beginning to love. So he was able to put a human face on the music that his parents had studied. Their study was pretty rarefied, done in the conservatory and in their studios. But Pete was right out there on the road with them, and he began to link the music to actual flesh and blood people. He began to see this music as a part of the working class struggle in the United States.
And when did he start writing?
Certainly by the end of the 40s. He might have tried something before, but the first song I recall that he really had a clear hand in writing was If I Had a Hammer. He and Lee Hayes, a folk singer from Arkansas who became part of the Almanac Singers with Pete and then later with the Weavers, they put the song together, and they performed it in the late 40s for the benefit of the 11 communist leaders who had been prosecuted under the Smith Act. That was to raise money for their defense. And then I guess to his great surprise and delight, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and other people like that, but above all, Peter, Paul, and Mary, took up the song and made a huge hit out of it.
Yeah, let's hear some of it.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the evening, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out a warning. I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land. If I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning. I'd ring it in the evening. Brothers and my sisters, all over this land. If I had a song, if I had a song.
Pete Seeger and If I Had a Hammer. As I listen to all of his songs, I am amazed, and it just speaks to how he became so ingrained in sing-alongs and children's classrooms and just a part of the American musical scene that probably most of us can sing all of the words to that song, Bill.
Developed the habit pretty early in life of keeping a little notebook, and he wrote down fragments of ideas and little verses of songs or potential songs. Like, you know, after he read a book by Mikhail Sholokhov, I think is the way he pronounced it, and Quiet Flows the Dun, he came across a poem about where have all the flowers gone, and particularly one line said, long time passing, which intrigued him. So he played around with that for a long time and then finally, you know, put words to it. Mm-hmm. And that became the famous song, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and another song that Peter, Paul, and Mary and others have covered.
When was he identified by the House on Americans Activities Committee as being a threat to the country?
They began to identify him with that sort of idea as early as the 1940s. He came out of the Second World War, having served in the Pacific, as patriotic an act as you can do. Mm-hmm. But he came back, and along with some others, he formed an organization called People's Songs. And the purpose of People's Songs was to build concerts and promotions for trade unions and other groups, and to spread the gospel of folk music as far and wide as possible. But above all, People's Songs had a political message. It was to continue the struggle against injustice through music. So some people began to recognize him and fear him because of that. And then the Weavers, during the war, you know, the Almanac Singers were very explicit in their political message.
And that was Woody. Woody was involved in Almanac, wasn't he?
Yeah, quite a few people. Bess Halls and Lee Hayes again, and of course Pete, Millard Lempel, I believe, may have been in that. And they sang all kinds of songs, but they sang some songs with some very explicit political messages, songs like Talking Union, and I believe that may have been where the song about the Union Maid was first introduced. I'm not sure about that. Singing the Reuben James. And in the beginning, they were very anti-Roosevelt. The Almanacs were closely linked to the Communist Party, and they were supporting Russia in its struggle with the Nazis. And they didn't really change their message until Hitler invaded the Soviet Union and Russia became one of our allies. Then the Almanacs dropped their anti-Roosevelt songs and began singing songs in favor of the war, whereas before, you know, they had opposed it. Mm-hmm. And then the Weavers, right after the war, say 1948-1949, they sort of evolved out of the Almanac Singers. And while they did a lot of songs like Goodnight Irene and Zana Zana, On top of Old Smokey, very non-threatening, non-political songs. They also did some political stuff. And so that's a long way of answering your question. But Pete was recognized very early in the 1940s as a possible subversive. And so amateurs and professionals began to take down information about him, and professional red hunters began to turn their information over to the FBI. And out of that, eventually by 1955, the House Un-American Activities Committee, you know, brought Pete in and cross-examined him.
We are going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about Pete Seeger's huge contribution to the world of folk music and civil rights and environmentalism and anti-war movement, because over 70 years he was involved in a whole lot of those movements and singing the songs that defined many of those movements. They really do. Bill Malone is our guest this hour, and he knows Pete's story pretty well, as you can tell. He's the author of all kinds of books on American music, has earned a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of American Music. He hosts a weekly radio program for WORT called Back to the Country, and is Professor Emeritus of History at Tulane University, which is, he's regarded, Bill is, as the nation's foremost authority in Southern music. Here's our phone number for you to join our conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thought we would play a little bit of Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and we'll return shortly and start taking your calls. Just a couple days after he would have celebrated his 95th birthday, the life and music contribution of Pete Seeger.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? Where have all the young girls gone? Long time passing. Where have all the young girls gone? Long time ago. Where have all the young girls gone? They've taken husbands, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
Pete Seeger and Where Have All the Flowers Gone. We're celebrating his life this hour and welcoming phone calls for him. Let's start our calls with Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess I know what Pete Seeger means to myself and my fellow Solidarity singers at the Capitol. Our songbook would be several pages thinner.
Yes, I bet.
And I also think it's not a coincidence that whenever you have musicians and music that are sung truth to power, it is viewed as a threat. It's always been that way. And I'm proud that we were able to sing his music. And I know for sure that if he was healthy and alive, he would have been there getting arrested with us, just standing up for what's right.
Thank you very much. Isn't that true that when you think about so many different movements, if you took away his contributions, the songbook would be a lot thinner?
Yeah, civil rights, anti-war,
right.
Environmentalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about his songs and, of course, where he learned a lot of his material. What we really haven't stressed yet is the style, the musical style of the man himself, the charisma and the ability to just get an entire crowd aroused. My wife's in the studio here with us today. We share one thing in common from the early days. We both went to the University of Texas, and we didn't know each other. She was very much younger than I. But the one event we know we went to together was a Pete Seeger concert.
Oh, really?
on the drag at the YMCA. They wouldn't let him play on the campus itself, so he had to go across the street. And people were passing out leaflets against him, you know, accusing him of being a communist. But we're still remember this day, the power that the man conveyed. I've never seen anybody awaken a crowd the way that Pete Seeger could, and to bring them into the song and into the message he was trying to convey.
They wouldn't let him play at the University of Texas.
Right. Well, that was back in the days, you know, when before you could enroll in classes there, you had to sign a non-communist oath. That's the very first thing you did.
He toured a lot early on in the South, too, didn't he?
Well, beginning in the 50s, after the House Un-American Activities Committee citation, I think he was shut out of a lot of forms of presentation, so he had to go out and just make an audience wherever he could find it. Mm-hmm. He started singing for at camps and on college campuses and just wherever he could get a hearing. And he was a much traveled man. You know, he would do 4 or 5 shows a day sometimes.
And at some point, he had to do 4 or 5 shows a day, didn't he? Because he couldn't get much work after that House Un-American Activities Committee.
Blacklisted from television and from a lot of big shows.
Right. Tell me the story of his playing, and we should play some of this song, too. Another of his causes was anti-Vietnam War. He was invited to play on the Smothers Brothers. Some of our listeners will remember that television show, and was going to play this song we'll hear part of in a moment, but the CBS censored the music.
You're probably referring to Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. Is that the one? Yeah. Yeah, he... Again, that was one of those fragments that he had carried around with him a long time. And this was a poem that had been written back during World War II about a platoon leader, you know, who couldn't, you know, who was very stubborn and led his soldiers into ambushes and that sort of thing. He was the person that the phrase, "the old fool says march on," that's who he was referring to. So then Pete resurrected it in 1966, and it just fit the mood of the anti-war resistance perfectly. You know, it became an anti-Vietnam War song. And then, of course, since that time, it's been used a lot. Bruce Springsteen, for example, resurrected it during the Iraq War.
And here is part of it.
It was back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the Big Muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, "Sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base?" "Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground." We were waist deep in the Big Muddy, the big fool says to push on. The sergeant said, "Sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim." "Sergeant, don't be a nervous Nelly," the captain said to him. "All we need is a little determination. Men, follow me, I'll lead on." We were neck deep in the Big Muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Waist deep in the Big Muddy, Pete Seeger. And we're on this day that's almost his birthday. His birthday, 95th, would have been on Saturday, but we weren't here on Saturday, so we're celebrating just a little bit later here on Monday. Bill Malone is our guest, who obviously knows music inside out and is an authority on Pete Seeger as well. Let's go to Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
About 25 years ago, I had the opportunity to see Pete and Arlo Guthrie play together. And
great.
It was a wonderful concert. And the stage was empty except a large rug and 2 stools. So they played together and they did solos. While Arlo was playing, Pete would go over, lay down on the rug, put his hands behind his head, and close his eyes. Basically take a nap. It was wonderful. And I think it speaks to how humble and natural he was. And obviously, you must have been a great listener.
Yeah. Where was the concert? Do you remember that, Joe?
Yeah, it was in the Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater, Florida. Wonderful place.
Yeah.
The Frank Lloyd Wright design building. It was a great acoustics. It was a good place to see see anybody play.
Uh-huh. Bill.
Well, I know Pete was a man of very simple taste. He, you know, he grew up in, of course, a relatively affluent middle-class home. But he loved the outdoors. He loved the wilds. He loved solitude. That's the reason why he built his log cabin near Beacon, New York, in the, I guess it was, the 1960s, and spent as much time as he could there when he wasn't out on the road, which was much of the time. And of course, the person who kept things going, made it possible for him to go out and do all these things, was his saint of a wife, Toshi. I think it's probably pretty hard to be a wife of Pete Seeger, but she arranged his schedule, she kept the family together, she fed all these guests who came in, you know, without being invited. People were always showing up at the doorstep trying to learn something from Pete, and so she always provided food for him. But Pete had him working. If you went to Beacon, you know, and you wanted to get something out of him, you had to go outside and wield an axe just like he did and gather firewood, that sort of thing.
So it was natural for him then to take on the cause of the environment and to launch the sloop Clearwater
right
in the late 60s, right?
Yeah, I think it's appropriate that the listener said, you know, that they heard Pete in the Clearwater Hotel, I believe it was, in Florida. Am I correct? That was the name of it?
Yeah, he's gone, but yeah. I think that was right, yeah. Thank you, Joe, for your call. Kurt in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Hi. We've been talking also, you've been talking about the House Un-American Activities Committee and what they did with Pete Seeger. It was about that time also, very late 50s or early 60s, when the youth department, youth division of a national church body that I belonged to at that time, the youth department invited Pete to sing at the annual assembly of this youth group, and that raised such a storm of protest among some of the members of that denomination, of which they then used as a part pretext, because they had been agitating already over liberalism, conservatism, and false doctrine and so forth in that denomination. But they then used the Pete Seeger event to increase their agitation, which 12, 15 years later led to the division of that denomination, which exists to this day.
Oh, my goodness. Mm. And the reason was because he was what? He'd been a communist, or he was...
He was supposedly a communist, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He was Pete Seeger.
Pete Seeger,
yes.
That was enough.
Yeah. You know, he had a way, though, just his whole style. You listen to him, and there's this wonderful gentleness about him, too, of disarming people. You know, you might be a radical, but there's something just really lovable about him.
Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, I think he was just a good man, and that came across in his relationship with people. Even though it was pretty difficult for Pete to be warm and intimate on a one-to-one basis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the bigger the crowd, the more comfortable he was. His parish was the entire world. At least he tried to make it that way.
Yeah. I want you to, let's hear a little bit of this, and people will, of course, be familiar with this song. It was made into a huge hit by the Byrds, but Pete Seeger took a portion of Ecclesiastes and fashioned a song out of this, and it's a song that everybody knows the words to this as well, but just a contribution of this would have been enough, right? It's really quite beautiful. Pete Seeger and Turn, Turn, Turn. How did this come about? We'll ask our guest in just a moment.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything, turn, turn, turn.
When you think of all the musicians, Bill, who have done really gorgeous and haunting and beautiful arrangements of this song, there are many, aren't there?
Yeah, the Byrds probably had the biggest hit with it.
Yeah.
Roger McGuinn and, mm-hmm. and the Byrds.
Mm-hmm. Judy Collins had a beautiful arrangement of it as well. And he just, was he just reading the Bible and thought, well, I'm just going to switch the words around a little bit and adapt them and make a song out of it? Do you know the origins?
Yeah, well, all I know is that, again, that little journal that he kept, he had some passages from the song written down in it. And sometimes it only took a phrase or so. And I think he had a recording gig coming up, and he had to come up with a new song. So he just pulled it out.
Oh, man. Oh, wouldn't you love to be able to do well? Let me just pull out, turn, turn, turn. We have a great email here from Facebook. A while back, I wrote a few additional verses to This Land Is Your Land. And on a lark, I sent it to Pete. Woody's This Land Is Your Land. I sent it to Pete, and surprise, I found a letter from Pete in my mailbox. He attached a letter that said, David, you've got some good lines here, but it's too long. Remember what Dr. Seuss said, if you want your words to carry great strength, use them with short, actually, he said. Short is better than length. Sorry for the haste, Pete.
And I think that's something Pete probably learned from Woody Guthrie. The shorter, the more pithy, the better.
Yeah. Kenneth is next in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I was wondering if your guests can tell me when that very popular song, I'm sure it was a million seller with the Weavers, Goodnight Irene, came out. And then when did the House of Un-American Activities began?
Well, the second question, I think it dates to the 30s. I think that's when they began to have their hunt for subversives. But Pete's appearance came in August 1955, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm. He was subpoenaed then. Mm-hmm. And this song, I love this song too. Actually, we have it, so I have to play a little bit of it. Goodnight, Irene. It was a huge, wasn't it a million? Wasn't it a Weavers song, one of the only Weavers songs to make it into the top of the hit parade for quite some time?
No, they had some others. Zaina, Zaina, even on top of Old Smokey made it.
Oh, was it?
So Long It's Been Good to Know You.
Oh, yeah.
But Irene may have been their very biggest. It has an interesting history. It dates back to the 1890s. There was a fellow on Tin Pan Alley, an African-American writer named Gussie Davies, who wrote the original. And it made its way out into the hinterlands, and the powerful singer and 12-string guitarist, Leadbelly, began singing it, and he brought it to New York. That's how the Lomaxes and the Seegers heard it. But then they changed it around a little bit. They dropped Leadbelly's reference to morphine. And also he says in the refrain of the song, he says, I'm going to get you now. So that didn't sound quite right, polite enough. So they changed that. I'll see you in my dreams. But they recorded in May of 1950, and it became a huge hit for them.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Irene, good night. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dreams. Sometimes I live in the country. Sometimes I live in town.
town. Sometimes I take a great notion to jump into the river and drown. Irene, good night. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dream.
We're celebrating Pete Seeger's, it would have been his 95th birthday today, and there's going to be a big festival honoring his life this summer. We couldn't be with you Saturday, so we thought we would celebrate today, just a couple days after that birth date. Bill Malone is our guest this hour. Bill, a professor emeritus of history at Tulane University. He is widely known as the nation's foremost authority on Southern music. He knows his Pete Seeger history as well. And we're taking phone calls. Here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Roger in Madison is next. Hey, Roger.
Hi. Every time we hear about Pete Seeger and everybody loves his songs and everybody loved his songs, but one of my memories of Pete, I was at Oberlin College late 50s, early 60s when he would come through practically every year.
He went there hundreds of times, I understand.
Oh.
He went there hundreds
of really?
Times. Yeah.
Huh.
One of his favorite places.
Huh.
Yeah. After the concert, he would continue with a group of folk singing people who were there at the time. Joe Hickerson, I think, has been the Library of Congress folk song person for years. And Bill,
yeah, and he added a couple of verses to a song, to Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Huh.
Yeah. But the thing that sticks in my mind is seeing him do the limbo dance. Pete could get under a bar, I think, lower than anybody else.
Really? And he was so tall. That must have been hard to do.
Well, he was one heck of a limbo dancer.
Did you know that about him, Bill?
No, I didn't know that.
I mean, well, how tall? He was quite a bit over 6 feet, wasn't
he? Yeah. Well, I know he's quite an outdoorsman. He loved hard work. And of course, was in the military. So I'm not surprised to hear that he had some... So those physical attributes, but I never heard about the limbo before, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Thanks, Roger. These memories are great from our listeners. We'll take more in a moment. 800-486-8655 is the number here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're celebrating the life of Pete Seeger this hour of the program and welcoming your phone calls and emails. Phone number 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and also you can reach us on Facebook, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Sarah in Zion, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. My mom went to Oberlin.
And,
sorry. And she was a piano teacher, and I learned to play guitar out of the Pete Seeger songbook, like I guess so many people did. And I just wanted to mention that my favorite song was it was called Kisses Sweeter Than Wine,
oh, yeah.
Which I'm pretty sure he wrote.
He certainly had a hand in it.
Little
yeah.
love song, not little. Mm-hmm. It's a very nice song. And that's all I had to say.
Okay. Well,
thank you, Sarah.
Yes, he did have write some of Kisses Sweeter Than Wine. I think I'm not sure who the other composers were.
Mm-hmm. How many songs did he write in his lifetime? Do you know?
No, I don't know, but it's quite a lot.
I had read somewhere today that he released something like 100 albums, if not more. That's a lot of albums.
Mm-hmm. Mostly for Folkways, too.
Yeah.
Moash and the Folkways Company were very good to him, particularly at a time when he needed it, you know, when he was being shut out of everything. And they just kept his music in print. And that's where people like Bruce Springsteen and others heard it. And a lot of the stuff that Bruce Springsteen did in his tribute album to Pete, you know, came from that period and that source.
Yeah. They did a CD together. Was it a concert in 2006, or was it just a recording?
The only thing I remember right now is the album that Bruce made himself. I don't recall Pete being on it. I know it was a tribute to Pete Seeger, but I could be wrong, but I don't remember him being on CD at some.
Okay. And what do you make of Joan Baez's comment at the celebration of his 90th birthday in New York? She was there, and Emmylou Harris and a lot of other country kind of folk artists. Her comment, "We all owe our careers to him," referencing Pete Seeger. Is there truth in that?
There's a lot of truth to that. And you have to give some other people credit, too. You have to give the, believe it or not, you have to give the Kingston Trio a lot of credit. You know, they came along with the ballad Tom Dooley, and it became a super hit there in 1958. And all of a sudden, all kinds of people said, well, if they can do it, we can, too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If they can strum a few chords and do a song and have it become popular, so can we. So Pete, though, he's the grandfather of the movement, despite what the others did.
Caroline in Wisconsin. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I just wanted to share that Pete Seeger wrote a song for our Dennis Sullivan, which is the
flagship
for the state of Wisconsin, a schooner.
Oh.
And he got all these people came to see him, and of course everybody brought their banjos and so forth, and they wanted to pick with him. And there was a 16-year-old in this group, and he said, "You're going to lead. You lead. You take us through. We'll follow you." And this kid's face turned red. He said, "Oh, no, no." And he says, "No, I want to follow you." And it just showed that kindness to the, you know, like a young person like that, and it meant so much. And that's what I wanted to share.
When was this, Carolyn?
It's right before Discovery World was built, so it has to be, you know, a good 10 years ago or so.
Uh-huh.
And it was a wonderful, we spent the whole day with him and his wife and all these great people who love music, and it was fun. And then he sang this song for the schooner, and it was just a joy to be with.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd share that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did. Brought up a great image in our minds. Thank you. Rich in Manitowoc, hi.
Yeah, back when I was in high school, we wanted to hear Pete, and the orchestra hall was sold out. So he evidently wanted people singing behind him, so they opened up the stage for stage seating, and it was, what a joy. That man came out, and it was just like a giant.
You know, his brother Mike was pretty much that way, too. He didn't have the charisma that his brother Pete had, but if Mike played at a festival or in a party or a jam session, he insisted that other people, you know, be given a chance to play, and he would just sit back and just sort of strum along. He didn't want to be the star at all. So both of them, in different ways, I think, did a lot to stimulate singing and music participation among their listeners.
What was his involvement in the civil rights movement, Bill?
Well, he sang at rallies all over the country. You know, he went south, and he sang in Albany, Georgia, and places like that, and probably did more than any one person to popularize the song "We Shall Overcome."
Mm-hmm.
It had been used since at least the late 1940s. A woman down at Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, a woman named Zilphia Horton, had learned it from some striking black workers in the tobacco plants in North Carolina. And so she took it back to Highlander. And then later on, a song leader there named Guy Carawan began teaching it to other people.
Hmm.
But I think Pete said the first time he ever heard it was in around 1947. And then when, of course, the civil rights movement really began to pick up steam, he began featuring it in his crusades everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the high point, though, was that in 1963, during the Great March on Washington, when that entire crowd, you know, began singing it.
Yeah.
We shall. I do believe.
shall overcome someday.
Bill Malone is our guest this hour as we celebrate the life of Pete Seeger, who would have been 95 years old on Saturday. And we lost him last year, but he gave us 7 years of involvement in the world of folk music and so many different causes that were near and dear to him, and many others in this country as well. Bill is the author of many books on American music and has earned a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Society of American Music. He is Professor Emeritus of History at Tulane University and acknowledged as the nation's foremost authority on Southern music. He has a weekly radio program as well on WORT. Let's go back to phone calls. Alan in Verona is our next caller for you. Hello, Alan.
Hello there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I just have to say a few things. I mean, I'm a little bit younger, but I'll tell you, the music of Pete Seeger is timeless, and the struggles that he went through and that he participated in, singing about, is just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have to say that, you know, we're talking about a legend, but you have another legend in your studio there with Bill Malone. What a great man. Great musician, and his historical accuracy with so many of the artists out there. It's just a pleasure to hear him on the radio and certainly listen to him on WORT.
Great. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. Exaggeration or not, I'll accept it.
I think it sounded right from the heart, don't you, Bill?
Oh, yeah.
It was right from the heart. And there is something about, it's interesting, this quality of timelessness, because you can't imagine any of these songs that we've played ever leaving us, really. Can you?
No, I think we'll always have them. And isn't it wonderful that we have these great recording technology?
Yes.
That forever we'll have the music of Pete Seeger available to us.
Yeah, and you hear him as a young man and you hear mm-hmm. him as the older man. Sometimes the voice is really very, very strong and he can just sing by himself, and other times he's got other people who he welcomes to the stage with him. It's quite something. Do you know anything about this big festival that's taking place? It's a free festival, I understand, in July in Poughkeepsie?
No, I just wish I could be there, but I don't know any of the details of it yet.
Well, you should be there.
Yeah, I'd sure love to be. My wife was whispering to me as we were going up, and I finally figured out what she was saying. I should mention that, of course, the Seeger tradition is continuing through his family. He has mm-hmm. a grandson, Tail. Tail Seeger Rodriguez is keeping the tradition going. He's not the only one, though, but there will be, if Pete's not around, there will be some Seeger who will be. Of course, Peggy Seeger's still alive, still singing in England.
Mm-hmm.
And she was here not long ago.
Oh, was she?
She was in Madison for a concert.
And then you have that strong association with Woody's, with Arlo and his children mm-hmm. as well, right?
Yep. So we'll have the music, and of course, not just the families, but just regular folks out there, like the people who've called in today. I think they'll continue to sing the songs, and in jam sessions here and there, we'll always be able to hear some of the great contributions that Pete made to us.
Yeah, it will be around for mm-hmm. a long, long time, no doubt about that. Which of the songs, we've played so many of them, and some of them have been identified as songs that are identified with the civil rights movement or with social justice movements. Are there any other songs that we haven't paid attention to that we should in the next minute?
Well, I received an email this morning from someone with your show, from one of the producers, and they mentioned several songs that might be played, and I'm just looking over the list now, and I see that we haven't played Wimaway.
I was going to end the show with that.
Yeah.
All right, we will do that. I want to thank you so much, Bill, for being with us. It was an honor to speak with you.
Well, thanks for doing the tribute, and thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too. Bill Malone, our guest, paying tribute to Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger, born May 3rd, 1919, and died January 27th, 2014. What a body of good work, huh? Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. The other thing Pete did was bring us world music, this song from South Africa.